The New Machiavelli by H.G. Wells. Book the First, The Making of a Man. Chapter the First, Concerning a Book That Was Never Written. Since I came to this place, I have been very restless, wasting my energies in the futile beginning of ill-conceived books. One does not settle down very readily at 42 to a new way of living, and I have found myself with the teeming interests of the life I have abandoned still buzzing like a swarm of homeless bees in my head. My mind has been full of confused protests and justifications. In any case, I should have found difficulties enough in expressing the complex thing I have to tell, but it has added greatly to my trouble that I have a great analogue, that a certain Niccolò Machiavelli chanced to fall out of politics at very much the age I have reached, and wrote a book to engage the restlessness of his mind, very much as I have wanted to do. He wrote about the relation of the great constructive spirit in politics to individual character and weaknesses, and so far his achievement lies like a deep rut in the road of my intention. It has taken me far astray. It is a matter of many weeks now, diversified indeed by some long drives into the mountains behind us and a memorable sail to Genoa across the blue and purple waters that drowned Shelley, since I began a labored and futile imitation of the prince. I sat up late last night with the jumbled accumulation, and at last made a little fire of olive twigs and burn it all, sheet by sheet, to begin again clear this morning. But incidentally, I have reread most of Machiavelli, not excepting those scandalous letters of his to Vettori, and it seems to me, now that I have released myself altogether from his literary precedent, that he still has his use for me. In spite of his vast prestige, I claim kindred with him, and set his name upon my title page, in partial intimation of the matter of my story. He takes me with sympathy, not only by reason of the dream he pursued and the humanity of his politics, but by the mixture of his nature. His vices come in, essential to my issue. He is dead and gone. All his immediate correlations to party and faction have faded to insignificance, leaving only on the one hand his broad method and conceptions, and upon the other his intimate living personality, exposed down to its salacious corners as the soul of no contemporary can ever be exposed. Of those double strands it is I have to write, of the subtle protesting perplexing play of instinctive passion and desire against too abstract a dream of statesmanship. But things that seem to lie very far apart in Machiavelli's time have come near to one another. It is no simple story of white passions struggling against the red that I have to tell. The state-making dream is a very old dream indeed in the world's history. It plays too small a part in novels. Plato and Confucius are but the highest of a great host of minds that have had a kindred aspiration, have dreamt of a world of men better ordered, happier, finer, securer. They imagined cities grown more powerful and peoples made rich and multitudinous by their efforts. They thought in terms of harbors and shining navies, great roads engineered marvelously, jungles cleared and deserts conquered, the ending of muddle and diseases and dirt and misery, the ending of confusions that waste human possibilities. They thought of these things with passion and desire as other men think of the soft lines and tender beauty of women. Thousands of men there are today almost mastered by this white passion of statecraft, and in nearly everyone who reads and thinks you could find, I suspect, some sort of answering response. But in everyone it presents itself extraordinarily entangled and mixed up with other, more intimate things. It was so with Machiavelli. I picture him at San Casciano as he lived in retirement upon his property after the fall of the Republic, perhaps with a twinge of the torture that punished his conspiracy still lurking in his limbs. Such twinges could not stop his dreaming. Then it was The Prince was written. All day he went about his personal affairs, saw homely neighbors, dealt with his family, gave vent to everyday passions. He would sit in the shop of Donato del Corno gossiping curiously among vicious company, or pace the lonely woods of his estate, book in hand, full of bitter meditations. In the evening he returned home and went to his study. At the entrance, he says, he pulled off his peasant clothes covered with the dust and dirt of that immediate life, washed himself, put on his noble court dress, closed the door on the world of toiling and getting, private loving, private hating and personal regrets, sat down with a sigh of contentment to those wider dreams. I like to think of him so, with brown books before him lit by the light of candles and silver candlesticks, or heading some new chapter of The Prince, with a gray quill in his clean fine hand. So writing, he becomes a symbol for me, and the less none because of his animal humor, his queer indecent side, and because of such lapses into utter meanness as that which made him sound the note of the begging letter writer even in his dedication, reminding his magnificence very urgently, as if it were the gist of his matter, of the continued malignity of fortune in his affairs. These flaws complete him. They are my reason for preferring him as a symbol to Plato, of whose indelicate side we know nothing, and whose correspondence with Dionysius of Syracuse has perished, or to Confucius, who traveled China in search of a prince he might instruct, with lapses and indignities now lost in the mists of age.